Well, hello again and welcome to another edition of AuthorsAudio.com. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can always visit us at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com and listen to all our interviews by clicking on the listen icon on the homepage. Today I have with me Jim Birkeland, a geologist who grew up in the Valley of the Moon in Sonoma County, just north of San Francisco. After receiving his BA in geology in 1958, he worked for 6 years with the U.S. Geological Survey. He then went back to get his master's degree in geology at the San Jose University, completing his course in 1964. After more than 10 years with the Department of the Interior, he resigned his position in order to work on his doctorate at the University of California. He started to develop a theory of earthquake prediction based in part on an alignment with the Sun and the Moon and the Earth called syzygy, that's S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. This alignment affects the tides greatly and can seriously strain fault lines affected by this extra tidal weight. Perhaps his greatest success was naming and predicting the Gilroy Dispatch, the Loma Prieta earthquake, or the World Series earthquake of 1989, 4 days before it actually happened. Erroneous suppositions about panicking the public, however, caused the county to suspend him for 2 months, and he was only allowed to resume his career after promising not to predict any more quakes on county time. It was then that Jim began publishing his famous earthquake newsletter, which he's been doing now for 19 years, called Syzygy. You can subscribe to it online now at his website, and he is the author of his book called The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. It's my great pleasure now to introduce you to Jim Birkeland. Jim, how are you doing today?
Could hardly be better, except for a computer crash last night.
Don't you just hate it when that happens?
Oh, always expect it. On your least can stand.
Well, I hope you're able to get this, and hopefully you saved some of your very important information.
Yes, I think so. Just trying to get it back.
Yeah, that's
the problem.
It's always a problem. You are the seismologist, really, who works with a unique subject. It's called syzygy. Is that right?
But let's make that geologist. We don't want to antagonize any real seismologists or geophysicists. I'm neither. I've had one course in seismology and one in geophysics.
Okay.
I am a geologist. I have taught universities on the East and West Coast. I've had about 40 years experience in field.
Mm-hmm.
And through most of my career, I thought that earthquakes were not predictable as they were random events because that's what I'd been taught and that's what I taught to my classes. Then I became Santa Clara County geologist, the first county geologist in Northern California in 1973, late that year.
Mm-hmm.
Was greeted by 6 earthquakes in the Bay Area, a couple of which I felt myself. On January 8th of that year, there was an article about coastal flooding, that people should be aware of the possibility of coastal flooding due to an unusual astronomical alignment. It was very similar to what we just had in early June. And that was with the Sun, Moon, and Earth lining up just hours apart from the moment of the closest approach of the Moon for years. And that produced extremely high tides around the world. And so if you had a strong onshore wind, if you had freshwater flooding meeting the high tide coming
mm-hmm.
in, there were a number of possibilities that would, the astronomy would bring you to the verge of flooding and the meteorology could bring you over the top. Luckily, in the Bay Area, we had no such condition, but it occurred to me, with the tide going in and out like that every 6 hours, it might be like having a wire between your fingers and wiggling it up and down and getting metal fatigue and pop. And I thought, crestal fatigue along the faults. Let's see, we've had 6 quakes. By golly, all 6 of them fit this strange pattern I thought I'd originated. Turns out that it's been around for hundreds of years, the relationship between tides and quakes.
Well, I have an RSS feed from the USGS on one of my browsers, and I every once in a while I check to see the activity around. I went to USGS today, and I went into their fact section, and it says, "Can you predict an earthquake?" And they say, "No, neither the USGS or Caltech or any other scientists have ever predicted a major earthquake."
Isn't that ridiculous? I'm right there in the newspaper, having predicted the World Series quake and named it 3 days.
Well,
I
knew that, and I thought, well, I had to bring that up with you, Jim. They happened to stumble into that.
That's the party line, and that's what they're back to where they were in the 1960s. And then for about 20 years, they were figuring they're on the verge of actually predicting quakes. We're only 10 years away from being able to predict it effectively. And then it was a decade away and 10 years away. And every time they would pronounce this, it was always 10 years further in the future. And then after their utter failure at Parkfield, where they had given a 95% chance of a 6-magnitude quake within a 9-year period, and it didn't happen. It happened after about 16 years. But that's a myth. And so they have not been able to predict a quake. At least I know of 12 attempts they've made, and they've all been failures. I had 75 to 80% of my predictions, and you had my prediction for June 1st to 8th. And you may have noted we on the 6th we had a 3.9 that was widely felt here in the northern North Bay area, including my hometown of Glen Ellen. And I called one for Oregon, Washington. They had a 4.7 off the coast of Oregon.
Right.
And Southern California, 3.2. Also, we had another one in the East Bay. On the last day of my window, the 8th, it was only 3.5, but that was the bottom of my predictive range of 3.5 to 6.5. But that counts 100%.
Yeah. What I'd like you to do is maybe give our listeners just a general idea of how you, all the different compositions that you put into a prediction. I know you talk about the syzygy, which is the alignment of the sun, the moon, and it basically gravitic effects on the ocean tides, I'm assuming.
Sure.
And but there are a lot of other things that you like to look into as well. Maybe you could speak to that.
After all, the whole world is subject to the same gravitational effects from the sun and moon.
Yes.
And so one would think the whole world had the same seismic window. It turns out not to be true. By looking at the actual recorded history of local seismically active areas, we find that some of those areas, such as Salton Sea and the Kamchatka, do not fit my theory that the earthquakes seem to be delayed. And that's fine. Just you adjust your local seismic window. But
okay.
My seismic window for the Bay Area and most of the West Coast is opens the day before a syzygy, and through the day of syzygy, and for the next 6 days, for a total of 8 days. And that picks up 75 to 80% of my predictions. But since that only tells me when, and not really where and how big, well, let's just look at what happened in 1989. At the outset of the year, I had been predicting quakes for 15 years, based first in 74, my first prediction hit 2 days later, based on tides, and then in 79, a physicist with Xerox called me at home and said, I agree with your upcoming seismic window because the cats are disappearing again. And I thought, what do you mean? He said, well, I look at the lost and found column in the Mercury News here in San Jose, and I noticed the numbers of missing cats increases just before local quakes. And I thought, give me a break. And then I realized that our own cat Rocky had disappeared on my birthday 6 days before the strongest quake in the Bay Area since 1911. It was a 5.9 quake about 30 miles south of San Jose.
Wow.
And it did some damage, and it was widely felt. And it was also the day before my window opened. So I was off, well, nine hours on that one, or 14 hours on that one. But the quake was, pretty impressive, being the strongest in that long a period. Well, at that time, the missing cats had gone from a normal 2 or 3 up to 12, according to Antonio Naferati, the physicist. And since I realized my own cat had fit this pattern, disappearing 6 days before that quake, I began to pay a little more attention to him and didn't hang up on him after all. And in fact, Rocky returned home after an absence of 6 months, having fled somebody else's house just 4 days before the next 5-magnitude quake in the Bay Area. And that made a complete believer out of me. And ever since then, I've been keeping the daily records of missing cats in the San Jose, and dogs and birds in the San Jose, Los Angeles, and San Francisco papers. I have, you know, albums full of the daily data. So I know what goes on. I know that right after the 4th of July celebrations here, well, the dogs run away in large numbers. But there is a clear stimulus, and nobody seems to have a problem with that. Oh, yeah, sure, the noise and excitement drive the dogs away. They're very ear-oriented. So, but I say, well, why would they disappear then way before a 4th of July or in the middle of summer?
Right.
Or any other time? And there are only three explanations I've come into. One is you just had the 4th of July, you've had a severe thunderstorm, or you're about to have an earthquake. And that happens time after time. So in January of 1989, I had been publishing my newsletter. Well, I had a little sheet that I handed out before I started my newsletter, showing the top seismic windows of the year. And I at first only predicted 6 or 2 1 year, and up to 8. And then through popular demand, they say, well, I'm taking my vacation. What about this month? And I said, well, it's not a very high tide month, but give me the best dates anyway. So I started giving the best window for every month of the year. Even in my percentage of accuracy went down from 82% to about 78%, because I was not just getting the cream of the crop, gravitational crop.
Right.
So anyway, once I was able to appreciate what this physicist told me about the cats and animals in general, I then was able to pin down not only the when, but the where, and sometimes how big. Depends on how big an area is affected. Now, we had a number of missing cats go to the record of 1980 with 14 missing cat ads on the 7th of November. And it turns out our local geyser did not erupt. Instead of the 40 or 45 minutes between eruptions, it did not erupt for 3 hours and 12 minutes. That still stands as the all-time record. And it was also, the November 7th was the day of the new moon, syzygy. The previous new moon syzygy, we had a 25,000 people die in Morocco. And the previous full moon syzygy, 300 people died in southern Mexico in Guatemala. So the next syzygy came up, and there had been no major quakes in between.
Mm-hmm.
And with three factors that had suggested quakes in the past, now all coincidence, I called the USGS hotline, maintained with Stanford Research, studying animal reactions at that time. They were considering the possibility that maybe their animals knew more than their multi-million-dollar instruments. And I called the hotline, and these hotline calls are recorded, and I predicted we would have a 6.5 or better in Northern California within a week, time, place, magnitude. And that's what's required for a legitimate earthquake prediction, mm-hmm. and within narrow limits. So 14 hours later, 7.4 hit Eureka, and that quake was felt in Santa Clara County, where I was working and living.
Yes. Yes.
So that indicated that bigger quakes have a greater effect even before they occur. The buildup of the quake causes stresses and strains in the ground and electromagnetic changes and tilt of the ground and maybe deep sounds. And so there are a lot of factors.
Yes, I understand that these enormous, and these are truly enormous pressures that we're talking about here.
Oh, yeah.
And there are different kinds of earthquakes. There are some that faults that rub up against one another. There are other ones that seem to rise. Am I correct on that?
Well, they all rub against each other, but some are sideways, like the San Andreas. And some drop down, like by gravity. Gravity faults the column, like Death Valley. Mountains going up and the valley's dropping down.
Okay.
And then there are these. The worst kind are the thrust faults, where the upper plate of rocks move up like up a ramp, and they are very destructive to structures on top on the upper plate. And some of these kinds of faults don't even reach the surface. And that's what happened with Northridge in 1994, and we had a Birkeland family reunion in Northridge ironically, that January 1st and 2nd, and I warned my cousin that her beautiful collection of Hummelware all along the walls, you should do something with that, like put on museum tape or a little bar across the front, because, you know, you're due for a pretty good quake down here. Oh, I know I should. Well, she didn't, and lost 90% of it.
No, you see? Yeah, my listeners out there better listen to this kind of stuff. Now, I know you concentrate a lot on the West Coast area of the U.S., but just for example, I know very little about this topic, but I do know about what they call the so-called Ring of Fire, which is really way from Japan all the way down to the under the Pacific, and then coming up through South America and the U.S. and Canada, correct?
A finger of fire coming right down the St. Lawrence River and pointing at New Madrid, Missouri. And that is an area where you've had a very frequent, I mean, the largest quakes on the East Coast have been up and along that belt. And
my God, I better watch out. I'm in Toronto. we're not on the St. Lawrence, but that's close enough for me.
It's amazing. It's an old geosuture, a supposedly healed fault, but it isn't totally healed. And part of the reaction is from the rebound of the earth after the ice, you know, a couple of miles of ice, 11, 12, 13,000 miles years ago, covering the Great Lakes and gouging out the Great Lakes and coming right down to where the Ohio River is and the Missouri River. Those rivers are where they are because that was the south limit of the ice sheet.
Yes. Yeah, so what is that fault? What is the name of that fault line running through the sort of more or less the center of the U.S.?
Well, it's a shear zone, a New Madrid shear zone, and then it goes up. Yeah.
New Madrid, that's what I'm thinking.
It's like New Madrid, but the locals there call it New Madrid, so I go along with that.
Yeah.
The first one, the great earthquake of 1811 on December 16th, was about an 8.5, and it was the day after the new moon, the day after Syzygy. And it was most interesting to read a U.S. Geological Survey professional paper, 494, written in 1912 by Myron Fuller, and he pointed out that six of the seven great series of quakes, so they had three over eight magnitude, that was December 16th and January 23rd and February 7th, and the whole central part of the United States shook, and it rang bells in Boston, and it caused the Mississippi to flow backwards for a while as a wave of water moved up and caused rapids and little waterfalls on the Mississippi River, if you imagine that. But those six of the seven of that series of quakes, according to Myron Fuller, occurred at the time of the new or full moon. Now, another USGS geologist published in July of 1989 in our most widely read journal, Geology, and he said strong relation between eastern U.S. earthquakes and lunar phases. And it was a very good job. And I could agree with him on several of the earthquakes that I looked at, including the strongest quake on the East Coast in the U.S. was in Charleston, South Carolina, on August 31st of 1886. That was just the day after the new moon and the day after perigee in what's called a perigean spring tide, one of only four such dates for the year. Extreme tides and an extreme earthquake.
Okay, I just wanted to clear this up for myself, because now I understand the moon is it's an elliptical orbit, and there's a what they call a perigee and apogee.
Right.
In an elliptical orbit. Now, when you're saying the new moon, and is that also corresponding to the fact that it's as closest to the Earth?
No, it could be 8 days away. The perigee, the perigee is 27 and a half days, and syzygy to full moon is 29 and a half days.
Okay.
But if you say syzygy to syzygy, it's just 14 to 15 days, half of that 29 and a half.
Okay.
Because both new moon and 2 weeks later you have full moon, but only one of those syzygies can be close to the time of the perigee, and that's the critical time when I have my windows open, because you always have the highest tides of the month at such times. Uh-huh. And not only tides in the ocean, but also an earth tide. And I can imagine what that does to magma chambers of below volcanoes. There's a tide there.
Yeah, I mean, these tides are, even in any just normal tide activity, the stresses are much greater, of course, on the areas where the tide is the highest, of course.
Yes. Well, let me tell you about 1982. In January, I had a window open because there was an eclipse of the moon, a perfect syzygy, on the 9th of January in 82. On that day, the strongest quake in New Brunswick, Canada, in 126 years occurred. It was about a 5.8, 5.9. And my wife is from New Brunswick, Canada, so her relatives were, really shaken by that.
And literally.
Yes, indeed. And so about a, my friend Stanton Friedman, I guess maybe you've interviewed him. He lives back in New Brunswick.
I haven't talked to Stanton, but I know his work very well,
okay.
Yes.
He married my wife's best friend, so we are close. And he had a science show back there in Fredericton. And he was there at the microphone when the quake hit. And everybody was a bit disconcerted. And he said, a little seismic activity going on. So I said, I wonder if my friend Jim Berkland had predicted it. Well, I predicted the time, but not the place, because I didn't know what was going on there. So I had a call from the New Brunswick radio station. And the gal said, did you predict a quake? I said, I predict the time, but not the place. But I didn't know about your water well changes and animals changing and maybe local magnetic field changes and tilt of the ground. And she says, that sounds interesting. Do you mind if I roll the tape? And I said, no, go right ahead. She says, oh my God, not another one. And it was a 5.5 aftershock hitting while she was on the phone with me. So she said, where was I? I said, you were about to roll the tape. Oh, darn, I wish I'd caught my own reactions. But anyway, she rolled the tape, played out that night on the radio. In fact, this was practically nighttime there, with about a four-hour difference with the West Coast. So 10 days later, I got a letter from New Brunswick, and the gal said, I hope you have an explanation for what happened to me. I'm sure I'm losing my mind. I know you've talked about animals doing weird things and running away, but I have a 48-year-old school teacher here, lived here all my life in New Brunswick. I never felt a quake before, and I never had any kind of sinus problems before, but 3 days before that quake, my head stopped up, and I had the worst headache of my life. The aspirin wouldn't touch it, and it continued. A teacher's meeting on Friday night, I couldn't stay seated. I was just constantly on edge, and I went to bed, early bed, and tried to get up early the next morning, and pain and pressure were there, but then after a short time, the pain and pressure disappeared like I'd just passed over a mountain peak. And as I wondered at this return to normalcy, the first tremors hit. So can you have an explanation for me? And I said, I know that animals are sensitive to forces prior to quakes, and it may be that some people are as well, and you ought to check with the university. Well, I'm a very, shy person. I don't want to get involved with that. Well, I had Stan Friedman give her a call. And she was still noncommittal, but, I was 4,000 miles away, and she felt kind of secure talking to me about this weird thing. When I went back that July to visit my wife's folks, we flew back, and then I rented a car and went up to the little town of Gagetown across the St. John River to see if I could find where the Cuddyback lives. I stopped at the grocery store, and they gave me directions. And when I got there, I saw a fellow unloading the trunk of his car. Have I found the Cuddyback residence? Well, it was till 2 weeks ago. They just moved to Virginia. She couldn't stand it, and she took off before the next quake. Just like animals do, it becomes the pressure a little too much. So I have never seen her or spoken to her since. But when I went to the university, I asked to talked to the geologist there, and I said, I'm a geologist from California, and I have an idea about the timing of quakes in general, and yours in particular. And the geologist said, it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon when the tides in the Bay of Fundy were over 50 feet high. We think that extra stress triggered weak place in the fault. I said, that's my idea. Would you please come to California and talk to some of my colleagues that just can't see it? Well, 3 months later, I got a letter. I got a phone call. From after the quake, 3 months after the quake, from this Sonia Cuddyback. Excuse me for troubling at work, but yesterday it all came back. And today we had a 5-magnitude quake, the strongest in 3 months. I believe I can't take it. I believe I'm moving out of here. And I said, hang on, if you don't like quakes, New Brunswick's a good place to be. And you'll find the frequency and the intensity of the quakes will decrease with time. And she was very noncommittal, and it turned out she did leave. So it was 3 years later when I got a call from a gal in San Jose who said, I know you deal with animals, but let me tell you, I can tell when quakes are going to happen around here because I get these terrible headaches centered in the middle of my forehead and about 3 days before the quake. And I said, does anything unusual happen just before the quake? She said, oh, yeah, the pain and pressure disappear, and I tell my family it's imminent. Well, there were two calls from 4,000 miles apart, and in between, there was a meeting of the American Association for Advancement of Science in San Francisco at Christmas time. There they announced for the first time they discovered this highly magnetic mineral in the human body between the eyebrows over the pineal gland. And that's where the Indian ladies paint the red spot, and there's that mystical third eye. There is a sixth sense of direction that apparently primitive people had. Most of us have lost it. And some people, it's just close to pain centers that it creates earthquakes. Now, I've had 15 women and one man report the same symptoms. So I know it's true. It's not just an old wives' tale. Some people get headaches prior to quakes.
Yeah, they're sensitive. They're sensitive to all this stuff. Yeah.
Just like when I used to know it in elementary school, I'd come out of school and look up at a cloud or a plane flying over, and I would sneeze. I like to sneeze. It feels good. So I'd look up again, sneeze, and sometimes get 3 or 4 sneezes out of a bright sky. Anyway, a lot of people, especially with darker eyes, not blue or green, they are not that sensitive to light. And so they don't sneeze because they get sudden influx of light. Well, apparently the visual centers in the brain are close to the centers that tell you we have an obstruction in the nose. And it just overwhelms that particular part of the brain for some people. So it doesn't mean everybody sneezes when they look at bright lights. It doesn't mean everybody gets a headache before quakes, but everybody's a little bit different.
That's a really interesting, concept that a lot of people, I'm sure, that are listening are going to scratch their head and wonder if some of these things are affecting them, I'm sure.
Yes. And then here's another one. If I were a geophysicist or a mathematician, that your mind's so focused, you have blinders on, and you don't really have much time to listen to this extraneous kind of material, old wives' tale. And I brought up in the country, and old wives' tale is part of my background. And I thought some of them are true, turned out to be true. But here's one I made up myself. A lady next to the San Andreas Fault, living close to the epicenter of the World Series quake, or Loma Prieta quake of 89, her little trained poodle was sleeping on the bed night after night, and one day he came back with this hurt look in his eyes and totally covered with mud. And his big companion, the big setter that the little poodle ordered around, he came back perfectly clean. Well, she washed him up, and the next day he disappeared again and came back coated with mud. And this time he had to sleep out in the garage, and he whined and complained all night long. And so this became a pattern, and this the worst, that was all the week before the biggest quake in around Northern California since 1906. And so she started calling me when she sort of thought there's something to do with her dog getting mud on him and the earthquakes. So she called correctly several aftershocks, the strong aftershocks. And this one day, I was just getting ready. In fact, I was already on suspension for having predicted the World Series quake. And I'd been invited to speak to the Santa Clara County Surgical Society at their annual convention at a big new hotel just opening up. So my wife and I went to dinner, and I spoke for about an hour and a half. Well, just before that afternoon, the same gal had called me and told me that her dog appeared muddy, and this time he was convulsing on the ground. And she felt him all over, couldn't find any wounds or anything, but there was a stick sticking out of his mouth, and she pulled it out. It was about a 6-inch long willow stick down his throat. She said, what is this going on? I said, well, I have to think about that. And as I was driving home, my days in botany suddenly occurred to me that willow is the genus Salix. I said, I wonder if that has anything to do with salicylic acid, which is the main ingredient of aspirin.
Of aspirin.
So I looked it up, and sure enough, Cherokee Indians chewed willow bark to alleviate pain. This dog had a headache, an earthquake headache, and was doing the best it could to alleviate the pain, like taking mud baths like wounded animals will do,
right,
and chewing willow bark.
Interesting.
Can you imagine that? And when I got to that part, this group of surgeons, the table talk really got intense. They paid more attention to that than anything else I said during the hour and a half. So you have to be aware to try to look outside the box sometimes. Maybe the answer was inside the box, and people just didn't look in the right corner.
I was just going to ask you, Jim, that we're going to talk about this massive China quake and also one in Japan. But is generally, do you feel that the Earth is shaking more now than over the last 50 years, or has it remained generally constant? Or
it's fairly cyclical. In 1906, we had 6 great earthquakes, 8 magnitude. They normally hit about once a year. 2 years ago, we had 4 of them. But in between, a lot of years went by with none. You'd go 2 or 3 years. Remember, the biggest quake in North America was the Southern Alaska quake and the tsunami of March 27, 1964, on the day of the full moon and extremely low tides at Cook Inlet. The next 9 magnitude quake was the one in the Indian Ocean in 2004. That was also on the day of the full moon. Now, to me, that makes perfect sense. But to my colleagues, they say, haven't you heard of coincidence, Jim? Just coincidence. And I said, well, how is it that the strongest tidal forces in 600 years occurred back in 1912 on January 4th? That happened to be the day of the strongest quake in California, Nevada in 1912, 1913. It's just coincidence. Sure. The very devastating Long Beach quake of 1933, March 10th, on the day of the eclipse of the moon. And my family moved us away from Long Beach just about 2 months before that quake, or I might not be here. Because the special committee signed by Governor Olson, scientists and engineers, evaluated what had happened in dozens of schools that collapsed. And they said, Governor, if schools had been in full session, as they were 4 hours before that quake, we would have lost between 10,000 and 30,000 school kids. That would have been like what happens in China. So that's when they adopted the Field Act. The state legislature acted that same month, and the governor signed the Field Act bill requiring special plans for constructing schools. And it was signed at the end of March that same year. And then the next big one in Southern California was the San Fernando quake on February 9th of 1971. Guess what? Day of the full eclipse of the moon. And when I was researching what the animals were doing at that time, I found in the LA Times the next day an article quoting the head of the Griffith Park Observatory. And he said, I think yesterday's earthquake had something to do with yesterday's eclipse of the moon. Not that it caused the quake, but it helped to trigger a fault line that was ready to fail. Well, that's exactly right. Well, all these brilliant people that I'm citing could see that relationship. But so many of my colleagues today, I don't know whether it's ego, a lack of desire to look at the... Well, they dropped their animal research program right after I'd predicted that, quake at Eureka I mentioned, the 7.4. That was the day after the most missing cat ads of the year and the day after the new moon in 1980. That tape-recorded message and where I made that prediction, somehow they lost the tape in the mail, they told me. The only one they lost in 4 years of operation, and then the next month, in December, they said, we're canceling the whole program because we found it didn't work. It was a waste of time seeing what animals do.
No.
Well, they're coming around to acupuncture and chiropractics. A lot of things they used to laugh at, and the need for extra vitamins. They used to say, totally unnecessary, the American diet doesn't need anything. So now they've bought onto that, because not everybody's diet is well-rounded.
Yes. Now, let's move on to this recent tragic earthquake in China that I believe upgraded to a 7.9.
Or 8. China called it an 8, actually. but
and it called it an eight. Yeah, they could lose. They could lose 150,000 people in one.
Yeah, if they told us the truth, I'm quite sure it was at least 100,000.
Yes.
They're assessed up to about 70,000 with about 30,000 missing. So they could easily
yeah.
get there. And what was my wife and I took a trip to China back in 91, and we were seeing them putting little houses on top of tall buildings. And I'm sure they weren't part of the original plans. They were loading up buildings that weren't designed for this extra load. And we saw the construction in many places, instead of using steel rods, they were using bamboo.
Oh.
So I'm sure they've changed a hope since then. But I understand that these schools that were devastated with the last earthquake, the steel rods are about as big as a pencil, which have very little strength. You know, for 3 or 4 story buildings, they had a lot of schools. There were high-rise schools, and they just collapsed like house of cards.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't take much to bring them down. I think you mentioned in one of your documents that you sent to me that this China quake ruptured well over 100 miles of ground surface with a maximum displacement of 23 feet. Which is was actually
yep.
2 feet more than the maximum of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. So this was a
right.
real doozer, this one.
And you get an eight or close to it. It's a very rare event, and it was on the day, the last day of the seismic window.
Yeah, and uh-huh. I'm just thinking of the average listener out here, and just, since we're on this topic. Can you explain very briefly how the system works as far as earthquake measurement is concerned? Like when we say a 1 or a 2 or a 3, well, how do people translate that into energy or something?
Well, before Richter really got around to defining the energy as recorded on seismographs, earthquakes were based on the modified Mercalli scale, which is what happened to people and things. So if you can barely feel a quake, well, you can be sure it's down around 2 to 3. If you intensity, that's a difference, the intensity instead of magnitude.
Right.
And most newspaper people have them totally confused, and it's logical, unless you've been told. With intensity 5, it means small objects topple over, little bric-a-brac in your house, but no damage, no real severe damage. But you get up to 6, and you get cracks in the stucco and maybe crack in the chimney. And you get to 7, you actually get chimneys toppling. The top of the chimney's coming down. Maybe at the top of a tree will break off. And you can feel it, used to say, while driving in a motor car. You can feel it with an intensity 7. Intensity 8 is really getting serious. And you're going to have deaths and damage in 8. It goes up. The San Francisco quake was an 11. And I'm sure they'll give an 11 or 12 to this Chinese quake. 12 is the limit. It's total devastation. Heavy objects bounce into the air. And you can imagine, you know, if your house has not been anchored to the foundations, your house bounces up in the air. And you exceed the force of gravity. And you couldn't stand whatsoever. In fact, it's hard to stand with a intensity 7. Intensity 5 or 6, you just generally get a kind of a seasick, kind of a rolling sensation. I wonder if it's something you ate if you're long distance from the epicenter. But
yes.
So with the setup from Charles Richter about 1933, he said, well, if we have a standard earthquake at 160 miles away, it'll make a pattern on a seismograph that measures so many millimeters. And so he then set up a sequence of how much you measure with a scale on the paper recording of a seismogram. And if you had a standard distance, and you have to then use a fudge factor to, you know, say it was from a standard distance, because you can have an 8 200 miles away and it'd give you the same reading as a 4 maybe 10 miles away. Although it would last a lot longer. Well, so the standard A-bomb, you know, Hiroshima-type bomb was about intensity, well, it was a magnitude 5.
Mm.
And that was typical of a lot of the nuclear tests they did in Nevada that have often 4 and 5 magnitude and up to over 6.
Wow.
And the Russians created a 7. So that's magnitude. You normally get, it's almost by the squares. You expect one great earthquake, 1.8, about 10 to 15 sevens, and 1,000 sixes, 1, 10, 100 sixes, and 1,000 5.
Okay.
And that year after year, that really pretty much applies. Now, a lot of people say, oh, we're getting a lot more quakes now than we used to. Well, we just have more sensitive instruments and more closely located, and the people are building right next to, you know, in sensitive areas, too. And so it's a general awareness of quakes that's increased, not the frequency.
Exactly, yeah. We do have an amazing amount of measuring capabilities of Earth movement now that it wasn't so long ago that we didn't have.
Sure, and communication, instant communication. I've been trying to have get an earthquake man like the weatherman on the, you know, what's the potential for a quake in the next 3 days. You know, it'd be easy enough to do, and it would reduce this level of possible panic from people that are totally unaware of, you know, they think the whole world's going to end if you get a 5-magnitude quake.
You have a newsletter that I want my people to be aware of, which they can subscribe to at your website.
Well, there's two separate things. I have the website, which is syzygyjob.com, and that's S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, and my initial J-O-B.com. Okay, and then my newsletter, Syzygy, was a follow-up to the two-page sheet I would give out for 20 years, but then after I predicted the World Series quake, my name became mud, and there was pressure from the federal and state governments to have me fired as county geologist. And I was suspended for 2.5 months and allowed to return to work only if I promised I wouldn't predict any more on county time. And so that's when I started my newsletter. And I've just completed the 223rd consecutive monthly issue, and I'll be picking it up at the printers today. And it's it will talk about the next window from July 1st to 8th.
Yes, now you have some general predictions I noticed here you sent me for June. Maybe you could just go over that very briefly.
Okay, well, June, we had a 9-foot tide at the Golden Gate. It cannot get higher than 9.2. On an ordinary day, the range in tides at the Golden Gate is about 4 to 4.5 feet. Then as you get a syzygy, it's usually over 7 feet. And if you get a syzygy and perigee on the same day, it's usually over 8 feet. Well, this time, you not only had that, you also had the summer solstice coming up, and there's a solstitial tide that enters in. So the tides hit 9 feet on the 3rd, 4th of June, and that's when we got our, you know, local quake 3.9, and then a couple of days later, 3.5 around the Bay Area, and the 4.7 up at Oregon. What I did lack was a major quake, a 7, during the window. However, Greece had a 6.5 or 6.6 that killed about 10 people in southern Greece, right in the window, and, you know, it was the biggest quake in the world, but it wasn't a 7, so I got no score for that prediction. But if people had been paying attention to the timing, and I'm sure there are plenty of magnetic field changes there, animal reactions, some people are sensitive, and most people are afraid to even talk about it they might be considered a kook. You know, it's sometimes they'll discuss it with their family. That's what I usually would find out from these people with the headaches. Well, I did talk to my family, but I wouldn't talk to my best friend about it.
Right.
Anyway, we lose a lot of information because people are failing to communicate. Mother Nature is doing all she can to communicate with us, and if we reject what she says, we're not being progressive.
Well, yes, and of course, as great as wonderful as science is and the scientific method and all that, there are other factors that come into it which may not be considered to be science, at least now.
Yeah.
And these factors, like you're saying, about the animals picking up and people picking up electromagnetic changes.
Mm-hmm.
After all, we are mainly water ourselves, and we are electrical, chemical beings.
Oh, sure. That's why you put the brainwave for telling truth.
All that stuff, right. So that's there are sensitives out there that I'm sure pick this stuff up all the time.
Yes. Now look at when you watch a flight of birds go over and they suddenly shift altogether, they're not bumping into each other. How do they do that? It's almost like, you know, the cloud, what do you call the your Canadian Air Force? I heard a speaker on that the other day.
The snowbirds.
Snowbirds, yes, it was great. And so they're almost like a school of fish, and they're communicating, and they know how to avoid contacting each other, and so that has to be electrical. I had a pet bobcat, and when I would return home at various times of day and different days of the week, my mother would know when to put the coffee on to reheat dinner, because she said, Jim's coming home, because the bobcat would get over and wait by the door about 20 minutes before I'd get home, and that had to be some kind of an electrical connection, a metal connection, psychic connection, if you will.
Yes.
I had to decide early on, was I going to conform or was I going to inform? And when I continued to inform, I suddenly found myself off committees, not getting raises, losing my assistants,
mm-hmm.
you know, just and I'm not able to publish. I had over 50 articles published until I started predicting earthquakes, and suddenly I found peer review would reject article after article. So that's another way that, that you have a type of scientific censorship.
Yeah. Well, I recommend that all my listeners go to your website. It's www.syzygy.com, which is S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, job, J-O-B, for Jim Berglund, and .com. And also, you have a book out, which is...
Yeah, Cal Ori. You can pick it up on Amazon, and I really urge you to see it because she deals not only with me. It's a little bit of my life story there, but also she's brought in some negative people, that, so you can see with her comments. But she really does a very good job, and this book that you can get for through Amazon for less than $12.
Yeah, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, that's you.
Jim Berglund, maverick geologist, and I don't object to the term maverick, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I think your work really, Jim, is opening up new ways of looking at this whole thing. And you know, maybe later on, all of a sudden, some of these guys will think, you know, that guy Jim was doing something pretty interesting.
Almost every one of the things I thought was brand new with me turns out to have been invented before, sometimes centuries earlier. But then
yeah.
Popular science rejected it. And so
I
relate to German geologist that talked about continental drift, and Wegener, Alfred Wegener. And he'd born in 19, he wrote first in 1912, died in 1930, the year I was born. And he encountered the same kind of rejection, and then it led to plate tectonics, which is about 99% accepted now.
Well, Jim, I really want to thank you so much for coming on Authors Audio and sharing with us your ideas and some of your ways of predicting. And I will send all my people down to your website.
My pleasure. Anytime. You're welcome.
Well, we've come to the end of another Authors Audio program. Today we had with us Jim Berglund, a geologist from California who predicts earthquakes. And make sure you get to his website at worldwideweb.syzygyjob.com. You can purchase his book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, on our website at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com. by clicking through the book icon. And until next time, this is your host, Jake D. Steele, saying, keep dreaming and happy reading. Bye for now.